at Ecclesiastes, Life Under the Sun. There's a couple things I wanted to mention to you. I intended to have them here today, and they're going to be delivered today, but not until later. But if you're interested, I did order some scripture journals from Crossway. They are essentially just single books of the Bible that have the text on one side and a journal page on the other side. Now, Crossway they print the ESV. So I know we'll be teaching out of New King James, though I've been using this quite a bit, so I may kind of bring in ESV as well. But essentially, I just find it very helpful, especially with a book like Ecclesiastes, especially with an Old Testament book of wisdom like Ecclesiastes, you've got to interact a little bit with the text so that some of the themes and some of the things that are repeated can start popping out of the page to you. You can see what the author's doing. When it's just the printed text without your interaction with it, it's a lot harder sometimes to see what's going on. So I'd encourage you, whether that's in your own Bibles or as Don does, you know, kind of prints and makes his own, or whether you pick up one of these, I'll have them here next week. Try and get something that you can interact with as we go through Ecclesiastes. Yeah. Yeah, so they have, Crossway publishes them now. They have the completed set. You can buy all the Old Testament, all the New Testament, or you can buy them one book at a time. It's about $6. And so Thomas Nelson is working on it. They're just a little bit behind Crossway. Crossway is, I think, the most advanced Bible publisher. They're doing an incredible job. And so Thomas Nelson's working on it. I was looking at their Ecclesiastes, and it's going to be released September of next year. So anyways, soon we'll be able to have it in New King James too. But these will be available next week. If you're the type of person that likes colored pens, that's exactly what this looks like in here. We just, again, so many themes, things that we'll be drawing out in the next few weeks. So that's one thing I want to mention. Secondly, I know I'm probably not even supposed to say this, but this is my second time through Ecclesiastes. The first was as a student. In Hebrew class, and that was really my first time interacting with Ecclesiastes with any level of depth, and it is a fascinating book, but it's also a very difficult book. It's not a book that, like many others, you can kind of take and start at the beginning and say, okay, I'm sort of learning the book as I go through it. You really have to have some comprehensive knowledge of the whole book before you even start, so that as you start, you're understanding what he's saying, or else it's really easy to get lost. So I am saying I've been through it once. Part of that is because I'm saying this is still very much a learning process for me. This is a tough, tough book. I probably bit off more than I could chew. But I hope that I'm planning on teaching it with you and even interacting on the book with you. And then immediately after, I'm going to do it again with the teens for my own sake and for theirs. This is a book for everyone. This is a book for those on their deathbeds and those that have just come out of the womb. This is for everyone, old and young, as we look at life under the sun. I want to interact a little bit with you. I only have two goals for today in the introduction. And it's really to teach you two Hebrew words transliterated into English and sort of what they mean. One, we're going to look at the author, and then we're going to look at one of the primary, the most commonly used word in Ecclesiastes. So those are kind of my two goals for today, is look at authorship and one of the main themes. But before we do that, just because I'm kind of curious and I want to get a little bit of a reading on your comfortability with exposure to Ecclesiastes, even what you've heard about the book. When we talk about Ecclesiastes, we're about to jump into studying this. What are you thinking? What do you think the book is about? Have you really interacted much with it? What's the theme of the book? Is anybody kind of willing to be bold or brave and say, here's kind of what I've heard or what I think it's about? Maybe first let's do this. Have you heard teaching through the entire book of Ecclesiastes before? 4, 5. A lot of times, probably everyone has heard Ecclesiastes 12. We have the conclusion of the whole matter, right? Fear God and keep his commandments, which is great and good. But there's a lot before then. It's not fair to just go to Ecclesiastes 12 and say, well, this is what the whole book's about. There's some truth to that, but there's a lot of punchlines from chapter 1 to chapter 12 that you miss when you just jump there. Yeah, Gary. Good. Okay. Just for the sake of the recording, I'm going to summarize that. So two things. One is that there's one of the themes is simply life under the sun, right? That it is, we're examining life as we live it, as we know it in a broken world. And then secondly, I'm glad you brought that out, is that it seems like Ecclesiastes is perhaps like worldly wisdom, whereas Proverbs is heavenly wisdom. Okay. And we'll get into that more. I'm going to put that on the shelf, but thank you. That's exactly kind of what I'm looking for is what other ideas do you have about Ecclesiastes or what have you heard? Let's say, how about what is the theme of the book? What's it about? Aside from just life under the sun, but what about life under the sun? Jerry. The inability of human beings to comprehend what's going on around them. Okay, the idea of a smoke or a fog, vanity, you're kind of bringing out one of the main themes we'll talk about today. That's one of the primary themes of the book, is that word for smoke, fog. Carol? Okay, a lot of contrast, a little bit going back to the proverbial nature of it, or the fact that you see wisdom, it's wisdom literature, right? There's a lot of contrast. What's wise? What's foolish? What's good? What's bad? What's better? Type of an idea. Old, young, the whole, yeah, fair, unfair. Okay, any other thoughts? Yeah, Gary? Okay, there doesn't seem to be any purpose. Many have interpreted vanity as meaninglessness, right? Life is meaningless. It's this cry at the beginning and the end and all throughout, which is why this is good. Johnny. Okay, so the idea of something after death, because death is a big theme throughout Ecclesiastes. Okay, so without something after, life here is frustrating and seems worthless. Mm-hmm. That if you don't have God, then whatever happens here is meaningless, essentially, is a summary of what you're saying. Okay. Okay. So the idea just mentioned is that if Solomon's the prime person to examine this, right? And we're actually about to talk about authorship. So that could be a good segue into that. No, that's perfect. Is that if there were anyone in history that has been divinely gifted with wisdom and wealth and ability to pursue down all these channels and arenas of what is the meaning of life? Where do we find value? What is the profit of work? What are, you know, all of these things? He's the guy. He's the one that we would look to. So I would say whether he wrote it or someone's writing as Solomon, it's either him or somebody portraying him for that reason, because he's the guy. If anyone's got a shot at this, it's him. Okay, one last question. Would you say, in fact, let's just do a show of hands. So two options. Do you think that the primary theme or the message of Ecclesiastes is positive or negative? If you think it's positive, raise your hand. 5 or 6, 7. If you think it's negative, raise your hand. And a lot of neutral folks out there. Okay, good. Close to split, a little bit more on the negative side. Okay, so some of these things, I'm not going to kind of show all my cards yet, but some of these things, we'll address some of that today. But as we go throughout this book, we're going to draw out, hopefully with clarity, I think the message of the book is. And I personally would lean more on the positive side. However, what we don't want to look at, what I don't want you to go into this book thinking is, I can't say that yet. Okay, we're going to talk about this later, though. Today, we will talk about that today. Okay, let's talk about authorship. So we our brother brought up Solomon, and I think probably most of us, if we had been asked who was the author, we would have said, well, Solomon was. And there's a reason for that, because it's been almost unanimously identified as Solomon up until like 200 years ago, maybe. Everyone would have said Solomon. Again, he's kind of the primary person, perhaps left like frustrated and disappointed after pursuing pleasure and pursuing profit, after this abundant way of living, that he kind of sits back and he contemplates life amidst all the mystery and the confusion and the lack of answers. And so as the man gifted by God with wisdom, he pens this book. So for centuries, everyone would have said, yes, Solomon. However, that pattern kind of got broken up when higher criticism came along in schools, really in like the 18th, 19th centuries. And they called into question the long-held tradition that it was Solomon, based on, and that started to gain kind of ground, and I'll explain why in a second. And even conservative scholars began sort of adjusting their position, and now probably the majority position is that he didn't write it. And they're even in a lot of conservative circles, so that one guy named Franz Delitzsch, who said, if the book of Ecclesiastes were of old Solomonic origin, then there is no history of the Hebrew language. Now, what he's saying is, he thinks that there are words and the way that Solomon's expressing himself, the words that he's using, that didn't exist in the time that Solomon lived. So it's almost like if we were to read Shakespeare and he says, good night, parting is such sweet sorrow that I should say good night till you text me tomorrow. And you're like, hang on. I don't think Shakespeare wrote that, because Shakespeare didn't text. So that's sort of in simplified form, essentially why a lot of people have shifted their transition, because their position on authorship, because especially when they were initially studying this, they're saying, I don't think these words were very prevalent in at the time that Solomon was living. No. There's definitely a strong response to that, and there's been significant scholarship on it since. I think, and that we can be comfortable saying was pre-exilic, meaning before the exile, and that Solomon is an excellent option for who wrote it for a few reasons. Well, first of all, why don't we look at the first three verses, which starts us into this conversation of authorship. So the first three verses read, the words of the preacher, Kohelet, I'll explain that in a moment, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? A little bit disjointed, but I do want to say one thing before we go back into reasons for claiming Solomon as the author. And that is the framing of the book. So a little bit of structure. Structure is one of, again, the most highly debated things about Ecclesiastes. How is it broken up and why? But if you look in verses 1 really through, I think it's 11, look at the pronouns. So the words of the preacher, the son of David, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. So is the preacher actually speaking in these verses? No, at least not in the way it's written. In fact, look in chapter 1, down in verse 12. Okay, so here the pronouns shift, and he says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart, dot, dot, dot. So we have a shift here. Verses 1 through 11 is like an introduction that uses third-person pronouns speaking about the speaker or the preacher, the teacher. And I'm just going to start calling him Kohelet. That's the first word I want to teach you, is that that's the Hebrew name for this book is Kohelet. And we, how do we get to Ecclesiastes? We got to Ecclesiastes because Kohelet means the assembler, the one who assembles, and he's like addressing the assembly. So then if you think assembly in Greek would be ekklesia, a Latin transliteration of the Greek is Ecclesiastes. So that's how we got to Ecclesiastes. So we're essentially saying Kohelet in Latin based on a translation from Greek. So we're just going to call him and the book Kohelet, right? So Kohelet is the teacher. He's the one that whose primary voice speaks throughout the book. However, he's not, at least literally, the one writing the first 11 verses. Or if you flip to the very back of the book, look in chapter 12, in verse 9. Verses 9 through 14 is the conclusion. And he says, besides being wise, the preacher, or Kohelet, also taught the people knowledge, weighing and setting and arranging many proverbs with care. Kohelet sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he spoke words of truth. The point being, you notice the shift in pronouns again, back to speaking about him rather than first person Kohelet speaking. Okay, so the whole book is framed with bookends of an introduction and a conclusion that both read vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So we kind of have the start and the finish. So whether this plays into the question of authorship, because it's one reason some people have leaned away from Solomonic authorship, because it looks like there's a narrator who's saying Solomonic things, or perhaps recording what Solomon said. But whether this is Solomon doing this himself, which is what I personally think, he's just using literary device to introduce and conclude his thoughts. But you just notice the two bookends, okay? So we kind of have the start and the finish of the book spoken in third person. Okay, so now reasons, I think, that we should at least be comfortable saying that Solomon is a great possibility, which perhaps this is pointless because you're all like, yeah, we're good with that. We can just move on. But this is one of the biggest debated things that it's hard for me to hurdle it without just saying it at least once. So reasons for it. Verse 1:1, right? the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Sounds like it could be very explicitly referring to Solomon. There aren't any times in scripture that the phrase son of David refers to anyone other than Solomon's or David's biological sons. Now, of course, the idea of son of David could be his generation, his genealogy, someone that was descended from him. But at least that has been used in the Old Testament, it always means a biological son. And then you have the statement of his kingship, which again is another reason to say, well, hey, Solomon was king in Jerusalem. So there's some at least support there. Another reason would be in 1 Kings chapter 8. If you don't mind flipping over there. 1 Kings chapter 8. This is not explicit, but it's just sort of some more evidence to support it. That here's the idea is that the use of Kohelet, meaning the one who speaks to the assembly, is very consistent with the person of Solomon, who he was. He brought people to himself from all over. Even you have references to like the Queen of Sheba, right? She came to Solomon to ask him questions. He spoke to her, men of all nations from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. So you have a lot of people coming to him to listen. And then here's other times that the same root word, kahal, or for Kohelet, is used. 1 Kings 8, verse 1. Now Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the chief fathers of the kings of Israel, to King Solomon in Jerusalem, that they might bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from the city of David, which is Zion. Therefore, all the men of the Israel assembled with King Solomon at the feast in the month of Athanim. Okay, and then flip down towards the end, verse 55. Solomon's praying, I believe, and blessing the assembly. So it was. Let's see, verse 55. Then he stood and blessed all the assembly of Israel with a loud voice, saying, "Blessed be the Lord who has given rest to his people Israel according to all that he promised." So you just have this, it's again, not explicit, not the biggest argument, but it's support, again, just for the idea that Solomon, this is who he was. This is what he did, was he was the teacher. He was Kohelet. People came to him and listened to him. So there's some support there. You have what our brother also brought up about, just the idea of wisdom, that if there was anyone to have addressed us, it would have been Solomon. You have the idea of his wealth. In chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, there's an abundance of his wealth is all described probably in the most detail, aside from the history books of Solomon. So you have the wealth of Solomon, the wealth of Kohelet that seemed to also produce that. And then kind of lastly, I'll conclude with this one, is that it makes more sense timeline in Israel. So if you think of the exile, pre-exilic Israel was more associated with prosperity and art and creation than it was with expansion, like geographical expansion. So the exile and post-exilic timing doesn't ring nearly as strongly with the message of the book itself, which has to be done in a place and a time where abundance is an option, where he can pursue an abundance, where he can pursue a pleasure, where he can pursue all these things. And exile, post-exile, don't make nearly as much sense with the message of the book. So hopefully I didn't lose everyone's interest in that. But I think we're comfortable saying pre-exile, Solomon is a great option. When you go back to the argument about the words being used, we have to understand that this is an extraordinarily unique book, first of all. It's wisdom literature. It is exploring unique themes with unique vocabulary that aren't used anywhere else in Scripture. A guy named Frederick essentially did all the hard work in the Hebrew, and he says, no accumulation of linguistic evidence speaks against a pre-exilic date, but the grammatical structure of Qohelet is fully in the realm of the pre-exilic language once one respects the complex nature of the book's style and language. Okay, authorship. And now you know Qohelet, yes. True. Yes, that Solomon was unique in his, probably the way that he thought and the way that he expressed himself. Absolutely. That's a good point, too. Sure. That's good. I'm not going to interact with it too much just because we have 10 minutes left. I want to get to the next thing, the other Hebrew word I want to teach you. But yes, there are significant arguments behind how wisdom literature works, even how Solomon works. Even if you look at, there's too much. Yeah, there's a lot there that we could interact with. But we're going to look at verse 2 because this is one of the main themes of the book. And we want to at least have, we're going to talk about this more and throughout, we want to at least lay a little bit of a foundation for the theme of the book. So vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. This word is hevel. And we're going to call it hevel for our time here in Ecclesiastes. When it's translated vanity, what other translations do we have? Do we have any others? Everyone's got vanity. Meaningless. Say it one more time. Futile. So futility of futilities. All is futile. Emptiness. Good. So the word literally is smoke or vapor, right? And so we have options. We've got options of how to translate it and very significantly what Solomon means by hevel. Because this word is used 38 times in 11 chapters. This is the primary but not the only theme of the book. So we've got to understand how he's using it and what he intends by it, or else we'll miss, again, you kind of miss the book, at least the first time through, and then you go through again, and you can reevaluate. So we have vanity, or as it's often implied, meaninglessness. We have temporary or fleeting as an option, enigma or mystery, paradox, or absurdity, or like an immoral enigma, an iniquity, are kind of our options. vanity of vanities, insubstantial, pointless, meaningless, futile, empty. There's a little bit of a difficulty if we chose to use that word today anyways, because vanity means something different at this point in the English language. It either means something you sit at to beautify yourself, or it means that you're self-obsessed. So perhaps not the best word if we were producing a modern translation right now anyways. But is life meaningless? Is life even for, let's say, an unbeliever who is without God, meaningless? Is it empty? Is it futile? Is it pointless? Does it matter? I'm going to say initially yes, and I don't think that's what Kohelet is primarily getting at. I don't think that's his main point, is the meaninglessness of life. It leads us definitely to a negative interpretation of the book. It leads us to something that Gary mentioned earlier, which has been a primary interpretation, that this isn't wise. This is worldly wisdom. This is abandonment of godly wisdom. And this is just angry. This is angry literature. I don't think that's Solomon's main point. Brevity, temporary, fleeting. The idea is that the word itself is an onomatopoeia. So, chevel. It's just, okay, so it's kind of there and gone. Like smoke, right? You have it, you see it, it's there for a few seconds, and then it just sort of disappears. It's into nothingness. Now there, I think, are times that Solomon uses this as the meaning. So let's look at chapter 11, verses 9 and 10. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these, God will bring you into judgment. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are hevel. They're gone so quickly. They're temporary. They're fleeting. There are several poems throughout the book also that address this cyclicity of life, that essentially generation after generation, life, death, it's just all so fast and in a cycle, and it almost, there's more to it than just temporary, but he does mean that it is here and gone very quickly. I think that's his primary usage, but it is one of them. Now, I want to argue primarily for number three and give you some texts why. Chapter 4, verse 7. Let's just flip to a few of them quickly. Chapter 4, verse 7. Well, I suppose it starts in verse 4. Again, I saw that for all toil and every skill for work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping at the wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Better a handful of quietness than both hands full, together with toil and grasping for the wind. Then I returned and I saw vanity under the sun. I read the wrong side of that. It starts in 7 and goes on to 8. So then I returned and I saw vanity under the sun. What he's about to say is that vanity. There is one alone without companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. So a lonely person working in isolation without the satisfaction of sharing their toil with anyone is hevel. Is that meaningless? No. Is it temporary? No. It's an enigma. It's the idea of you have this smoke here and you like try to get at it and you can't. Like it's there. We can all see it. It's a thing, but we can't understand it. We can't do anything with it. It's like another phrase he uses is shepherding the wind. You can't shepherd the wind. You try to corral it. You try to understand it. You try to say, this is what it means. This is why it happens. And you can't. And it's frustrating because it doesn't make sense. Chapter 6, verse 2. So I want to just give you one example, but look at a few. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires. Yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity and an evil affliction. So you lack the power to enjoy the wealth, possession, honor, but instead a stranger enjoys them. That's hevel. That's frustratingly confusing and mysterious. That kind of makes you want to take a step back and say, I don't know about that. I don't get it. I don't get it. Chapter 8. Verse 14. I know we're out of time. We'll wrap up here in a minute. There is a vanity which occurs on earth, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. Again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. I say that this also is vanity. So if the righteous person does right and they receive the results of wickedness, and wicked people meanwhile are receiving the results of righteousness, that doesn't make sense. It's not temporary or fleeting exactly. That's not his point. That would be a good thing. He's frustrated by it. It's an enigma. It's a paradox. The fourth is absurdity or iniquity. And essentially, this comes from a singular commentator. His name is Fox. And he makes a very good point that enigma is neutral. It's morally neutral. And he says, no, this isn't morally neutral. This is bad. And there's truth to it. But he runs like way too far and basically is saying that, so therefore, because there's this disconnect between what's there's this disconnect between my action and the result. And since there's that discontinuity, if I do something righteous, something good doesn't always happen to me, since that's, we live in a broken world, then God must have designed that to cause us to fear. Because the whole point is to fear God. It's kind of this weird, he goes way too far, sort of falls off the cliff on the other side of his initially good argument. That it's not just mysterious, like, I don't understand it, but that's okay. He's like, no, this is like really frustrating. This is feels wrong, and it is wrong because it's life in a broken world. So really what Ecclesiastes is doing, I have more to say. I'm close, we're close, but I don't know if I can, I'm already a minute after. Okay, really quick. One thing, I don't even know if you can read that. One thing about wisdom literature, sort of how it's all working, because I want to say this week so we can move on next week. If you look at Proverbs, the light of the righteous rejoices, but the lamp of the wicked will be put out. Proverbs is full of like wonderful things. Like when you do righteous things happen to you. When you're wise, and if you look at life, yeah, this makes sense. Somebody that's full of character and honest and kind, life tends to go better for them than somebody who's just burning relational bridges and lying and doing all these things and just making a mess of their lives. Sure, one works out better than the other. But does that always happen? No. It doesn't always happen. And so you might look at Proverbs and say, that's not right. I've seen it go another way. That's not right. I saw a great man, a good man, a righteous man, and he died at 40. That's not right. That's hevel. Or even, that just reminded me of Nabil Qureshi, who was a phenomenal young scholar. He wrote several great books. He was working with Ravi Zacharias. I think he got colon cancer, died, had a wife and like a 3-year-old daughter. That's hevel. That doesn't make sense. And it's frustrating. That's broken. But does that mean life is meaningless? No. That's not what he's getting at. That's not what he's saying. Okay, so we have Proverbs saying this, and then we have Job come in, and he's like, well, how often is the lamp of the wicked actually put out? In Job's life, it certainly didn't seem like it. And then you have somebody like Ecclesiastes or Qohelet come in and he says, I've seen everything in my days of vanity. There's a just man who perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man who prolongs his life in wickedness. That's not right. So really, Ecclesiastes, I'll say it's, you have three like sages who are discussing life, Proverbs is true. Proverbs is Proverbs. It's not promises. Proverbs is Proverbs. But Proverbs is true. Job is true. Ecclesiastes is true. So Ecclesiastes is dealing with like this gray area. It's like a disconnect where things don't seem like they're working. And it deals with your expectations about life and about God. You realize that you were expecting something when you don't receive it, right? So when life doesn't give you what you thought it should, when God isn't there the way you thought he should be, when he doesn't determine or decree the things you think he should, then you realize your expectations about life are off, and a lot of people toss God in the garbage heap because of something like Ecclesiastes, or they've never read it or considered it. And we essentially have to face life honestly, is what Ecclesiastes helps us do. Is it says, yeah, it's broken. Yeah, it's cursed. It doesn't always make sense. There's a lot of hevel. But the book of Ecclesiastes, it's a starting point, at least. Okay, let's pray.